From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more coming up.
Concerns grow louder about a proposal to widen Interstate 30 in central Arkansas.
The state launches its own health insurance service, and the governor changes his recommendations.
Arkansas's highest court throws out a challenge to the state takeover of the Little Rock School District.
Broadband access for every Arkansan, a new goal from state officials, but at what cost?
It's the Weekend Review podcast from KUAR for the week ending October 30th. I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
Well, Michael, at next week's meeting of the Little Rock Board of Directors, a contentious issue before the board, the possible expansion of Interstate I-30 from 6 to 10 lanes and the ways that might impact downtown Little Rock, especially near the Clinton Center, there's been some negative response to the plan. What's the state of that conversation now?
Well, local leaders are really starting to get louder about their concerns over this proposal to expand Interstate 30. I think to a degree, alarm bells are finally starting to go off in the heads of a lot of officials, especially after a couple of decades of building up the area downtown, the River Market area, also what the Clinton Presidential Library has meant for that region east of Interstate 30, Heifer International, also now proposals to do more on the east side of the interstate. And the Little Rock Board of Directors is going to be considering a resolution to oppose the project. The Highway Department, on the other hand, sent a letter to the Little Rock City Manager this week asking for the opportunity for its director, Scott Bennett, to be able to make a presentation to the board before they actually vote on this resolution. And this is Danny Strasley, a spokesman for the Highway Department, about really what they're wanting to convey to the board.
There's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding floating around about the project. And, of course, something of this magnitude, all types of rumors and misunderstandings float around. We see this at the local level in small towns when we're looking to widen small highways throughout the state. And, of course, it's going to happen here in Little Rock where you have such a large project that's going to be undertaken in the heart of downtown Little Rock and North Little Rock. And so our request to the City Board of Directors is to be placed on the agenda for their November the 3rd meeting so that we can make an official presentation to the Board of Directors to clear up any misconception that any of them or any other member of the public who is attending that meeting might have about the project.
And City Manager Bruce Moore has indicated he will allow the Highway Department to address the board and try to alleviate some of these concerns. But to give a little bit of perspective on this and the concerns, as I said, the downtown area, it's been about two decades now in the making to really build this up. 20 years ago, this was an area that was pretty much abandoned warehouses, just an industrial district that didn't have much life. And I thought it might be fun to dig into the KUAR archives and go back 20 years to an interview that I did in 1995. This was when I was hosting a weekly half-hour interview program as part of an independent study class. There was a proposal that was going to be going before voters to consider using tax dollars for what was then called the River Project, which was going to involve expanding the convention center, building what is today Verizon Arena in North Little Rock, converting the first of the two railroad bridges that were eventually converted into pedestrian bridges. But a key part was taking these abandoned warehouses and turning them into what is now an entertainment district for the city. Has proven to be very prosperous, but a lot of people weren't sure about it. But this was from my interview from 1995 with then-Mayor Jim Daley of Little Rock.
Then move on farther down to the east, and you get past La Harpe and Cumberland there, and there's a district that is being actually formed that came out of the community Future Little Rock, which is called the East Markham Cultural and Entertainment District. And the money is already in place for the streetscaping there, which will turn that into a nice place for people to walk and move around on the old East Markham. The old terminal warehouse is where 40,000 square feet of the new Museum of Science and History will be going into that, along with shops and restaurants and possibly some condos and what have you in that huge old building. Right next to that and backing up to the riverfront and fronting on East Markham will be the new Farmers Market, permanent home for that. The money is already appropriated for that. It's a public-private partnership. It's going to be a Seattle, San Francisco-type Farmers Market. Then you add to that the new library that's going into the old Phones Brothers building on 2nd and backing up to Markham Street itself. And those are just a few of the things that are already in place, and they're going to happen with or without the passage of this. But if you add to that the things that we've talked about with the river project itself, I mean, you can begin to see that we're talking about major change that is going to be of tremendous benefit to our community and make our central core and downtown an exciting place.
And voters did end up approving that proposal in August of 1995. And since that time, the downtown area has seen a very large boom. You've had a lot of condos go in there. You've had, of course, all the restaurants, bars, and it's proven to be a big draw to that area. So officials are expressing growing concern that this highway expansion could threaten what they've worked so hard to develop. And I know, Chris, you've spoken with a lot of people who have expressed concerns about this.
Yeah, like Kathy Webb, she's a city director on the board, and she's sponsoring or authoring the resolution to oppose the highway expansion. And here are her thoughts on that.
I think that the project as it stands now will be divisive to the city. So it will have a detrimental impact on the River Market and on other neighborhoods, Hanger Hill, and other neighborhoods where there's great revitalization. And I think if the board is willing to take a stand against it as it currently is, you know, that would hopefully carry some weight with the people who are working on the project.
Any resolution passed by the board would not have a real binding effect on what the highway department does. They have no jurisdiction over the I-30, but Kathy Webb and others likened this project to a similar project that was completed in the mid-70s, the I-630 project, which is seen as a divisive one, both on social and class grounds. Another thing that some critics of this plan talk about is the potential effect on traffic, not only in that corridor, but in surrounding corridors in the interstates that feed into it and feed out of it. A lot of people talk about how widening the highway to 10 lanes will essentially induce a demand for more vehicular traffic. And I spoke to Jim McKenzie. He's the executive director of MetroPlan. MetroPlan is an agency funded by local area governments, and they're tasked with coming up with initiatives and studying urban growth and kind of authoring plans that will guide the cities in their development projects.
The freeway system as a whole works as a system and seeks equilibrium in balancing congestion points. It also impacts people's locational decisions depending on the level of congestion. So if you widen one link, then you've got this phenomenon called induced traffic where the widening draws more vehicles to that corridor than would normally choose to go that way and compresses the time that they choose to be there. So then you've got issues about, so the corridor is effective in moving traffic faster through it because it's wider, but then if the entire system still has choke points in it, then that traffic hits the choke points and it'll back up in the corridor and defeat the purpose.
Now, MetroPlan can't take an official position on the project, but they do note that if what McKenzie is talking about were to happen, that would be an additional cost to the highway department.
And worth noting, too, that the highway department this past week did expand the comment period for this project. Normally, it's 15 days, but they had so many people come out at a meeting last week, 400 people, more than that, to this one public hearing. So highway officials said they would expand the comment period an additional month, a total of 45 days, ending on Sunday, December 6th. And highway officials also have been stressing that nothing is cemented, that they're still looking and considering different options about how to move forward with this, maybe doing not 10 lanes, but maybe 4 lanes in each direction, total of 8. They say that they are open to different suggestions being made and are trying to emphasize that to the public.
Yeah, and actually this week, the Downtown Little Rock Partnership had requested a moratorium be put on the plan, but the director of the AHTD, Scott Bennett, seemed resistant to that. He said that extending the comment period would be enough. So there's a little bit of tension between the highway department and local government.
It has been interesting, the kind of debate that this has brought out, and the fact that it has brought back up the history of I-630, the fact that it cut through and pretty much decimated what was a thriving black community in Little Rock, and just where these projects often go are the people who can least afford to fight. You've also had people who've brought up how in a lot of cities around the nation, and as well as around the world, they've actually taken out places where interstates or freeways once ran, and it sparked a very interesting debate among the public as this project progresses.
Well, next week, the state is launching its healthcare online marketplace for small businesses to purchase plans for their employees and determine how much they're going to put into the employee healthcare. This is funded by a $100 million federal grant. So the head of the state's marketplace, Cheryl Gardner-Smith, says that this is part of a bifurcated rollout of the marketplace that will be run on the state level. And the second year, individuals will be able to purchase insurance through the website.
Instead of calling the 800 number and waiting for healthcare.gov to take possibly days or even weeks to reset that, we were able to reset in just a couple minutes. So we're very responsive.
And I spoke to the governor this week also, and he says that actually, to his thinking, there is no need for an individual opportunity to purchase healthcare through the state level. Those individuals could just go through healthcare.gov, and that the leaders of the state marketplace have agreed to that vision. So there seems to be a lack of clarity on what will happen with the state-run website. Jacob, the governor made an announcement this week that he's changing his expectations for Medicaid expansion in the state. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so this is a separate issue than the idea of setting up state-based insurance exchanges, but it's part of the larger picture of Arkansas having to choose and pick from all sorts of federal and state-based examples about what we're going to do in this really transitionary time for healthcare reform. So a task force set up by the last legislative session is supposed to figure out by the middle of December what Arkansas is going to do with Medicaid, what it's going to do with the private option and Medicaid expansion, and all these hosts of other things that came with the Affordable Care Act. And this will be the second or third time Arkansas has to decide, because it's very politically contentious for the state legislature that's dominated by Republicans to adopt anything related to the Affordable Care Act. But the governor had two recommendations that he has since walked back, and he walked them back this week. The first one was, originally he proposed moving a lot of people in the private option population, which are low-income people that get federal dollars to have private insurance. He was going to try to push those people that got private plans with government money back into traditionally federally run, government run Medicaid. And there are two reasons. One, he thought it'd be cheaper. And two, it was sort of almost in a way of reducing the quality of an entitlement to able-bodied people in a way that kind of appealed to a lot of conservative lawmakers that don't like that maybe low-income, able-bodied people are getting good quality private health insurance plans. A lot of people think Medicaid is worse. It's arguable if that's true or not. So he walked that back. And the second one was the governor originally proposed getting rid of non-emergency transportation for, and this is particularly important for people in rural areas, the elderly, the disabled, people who don't have a lot of family members or friends. Basically, it means you get to go to the doctor and a van will come pick you up instead of having to call the emergency room down the line. And then another reason was that is a lot of legislators thought, oh, what a luxury. We're going to come pick you up. The government's acting like a taxi service almost. And so the governor walked those back. And the primary reason is because the healthcare task force had a consultant group called the Stevens Group. And they said, even if you guys want to do this, you think it's better, you're going to end up costing more money in the long run. It turns out it's better to have people on these private plans. You should probably just continue that instead of shifting them back to Medicaid. And it's better to let people go to the doctor when they need to, or when they think they need to, if it's going to be earlier on. Because the longer that you wait, it's usually more expensive and more complications would emerge.
Jacob, so, that healthcare task force is going to issue a report sometime in the middle of the December. What big questions is it answering?
The biggest question going into it appears already to have been answered, and that was going to be, are they going to keep the expansion of Medicaid that the Affordable Care Act provided? Which basically means that a lot of people who don't make enough money to buy private insurance on their own would then get it through Medicaid. So that's the biggest question. It seems like the governor, at least, and state legislative leaders have said, we're going to keep Medicaid expansion. So the big questions going forward are, what changes are they going to make to it? And also, the bigger question would be, Medicaid beyond Medicaid expansion, just the regular Medicaid population, it's $1 billion over a course of 5 years or so. So it's every little change adds up to tens of millions of dollars.
Well, this week, the state Supreme Court ruled on the state takeover of the Little Rock School District. The district former board members had argued that the takeover was arbitrary, and a circuit court judge, Wendell Griffin, was hearing the case, and the Supreme Court actually intervened and took up the issue as to whether or not the state was immune from a suit at all. Chris, you covered this. What was the Supreme Court's message about this issue?
Well, they ruled that the state did not act arbitrarily or capriciously or in bad faith, as the three former board members and one area voter had contended in court, basically saying that the state takeover of the district, which happened back in January when the State Board of Education voted very narrowly to assume control of the district, their actions were legal. Now, of course, this was a disappointment to the former Little Rock School Board members, and I spoke to a couple of them. C.E. McAdoo was one of the parties in the suit, and here's his initial reaction.
Being a child of the 60s, of someone who graduated from high school in 1965, and right as the Voting Act was initiated, I'm very disappointed for the African-American community particularly, for two reasons. Number one, votes in majority African-American districts has now been dissolved and discounted. And number two, that the leadership of a district that's 65% minority has now does not have any say in terms of leadership. So I'm very, very disappointed from those two perspectives.
And a little background, more background on this, and Sarah, you've covered this extensively. An African-American majority was elected to the local school board back last fall, and several months later, the state made took measures to take over the district on the basis that there are six distressed schools in the district. A lot of the former school board members contend that the reason for taking over the district was not because of academic distress. It was because the authorities in state government were unhappy with the idea of African-American control over the district. Now, of course, state leaders reject that argument. But I also spoke to Jim Ross, who's a former school board member, who is one of the more vocal members. I talked to him about what's next for the school district and his side in the fight, and he pointed to the federal lawsuit which is still ongoing.
The only options before us are that the State Board of Education come to its senses and restore local democracy, allow African Americans to rule their own destinies. If all the options are taken from us, as they were in the 50s and 60s, the only other option is nonviolent protest. So maybe we'll be involved in that. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just retreat into the place that people retreat. I haven't thought that far yet.
State Commissioner, Education Commissioner Johnny Key sent out a statement. He said, "We are pleased with the Arkansas Supreme Court's decision regarding sovereign immunity, this category that the state is put under, which prevents them from being sued."
So the federal suit is over a separate issue.
I think the federal suit's over a range of issues, yeah, but about racial disparities.
It doesn't hinge on that sovereign immunity defense, I guess, for the state. They'd have a whole set of different issues they'd have to defend themselves on.
The federal lawsuit is based on the Equal Protection Clause, and it's about racial issues and equal access to education, but the state Supreme Court was specifically about this legal question of sovereign immunity and whether the state could be sued for taking over the district.
Right.
Right. So I'm just saying, in a way, that the state Supreme Court argument is not about the merits of some of these individual concerns that the dissolved school board and John Walker might have about the quality of education.
Well, it's interesting, the question of whether the decision was arbitrary, because I spoke with Sam Ledbetter, who was then the head of the State Board of Education while they were considering whether to take over the school district, and I asked him what were the criteria for this takeover, and he said, you know, this hasn't been done before on the basis of six schools in academic distress, and actually there aren't any specific criteria for the decision. But that said, the state Supreme Court found that the decision was legal and that it can't be legally challenged because the state had the right through the state board to take over the school district. I spoke with the governor this week also, and I asked him about measures of accountability for the district. He said that Baker Curris, superintendent of the Little Rock School District, and Education Commissioner Johnny Key, that they were doing a good job, and that he had challenged them to come up with some sort of assessment for those six schools in distress to gauge their progress.
We need to have comparable testing to see progress and to be able to measure progress in those non-performing schools. And so, Commissioner Key, they're looking at ways to measure performance on a regular basis. And hopefully when we get them up performing, obviously our responsibility is to turn the school back.
That's interesting, of course, given that the state will have seen three different assessments by next year. So there was the benchmark assessment and then the PARC, which is a Common Core tied assessment. And then the governor specifically insisted that be dropped for a contract with ACT, despite recommendations of the state board. So it does seem to be a bit inconsistent in a way that they would like to assess the schools and yet don't have an assessment to be able to do that. So that is something that he's now tasking the local level leaders to resolve.
And the previous assessments that they used to make these determinations of academic distress, they've kind of implied were faulty in some way if they wanted to get rid of them and replace them with something else.
Of course, the PARC assessment was an online assessment, required a lot of time out of the school day for teachers to teach to it, and then was tied to Common Core and was widely unpopular. So there might have been other reasons aside from the value of the assessment. Of course, the state has not done particularly well on the PARC assessment. Majority of students were below expectations or below adequate standards on that assessment. So it's unclear that they'll be doing better in the first year of a new assessment either. Might be a while. Jacob, you covered a committee meeting this week on new goals for broadband access as a priority for the next legislative session. How has this come up?
This has come up as the past several years, state legislators have really struggled, in part because of things like Common Core and state-level assessments about how to get schools to have good quality internet connections. And part of through that study of trying to figure out how to get broadband speed internet into every school was the realization that if you provide good internet at the school, the student can't go home and go forward with that. And we've also talked a lot about in healthcare about telemedicine being important, particularly in the future. But if you don't have good internet speed, you can't use telemedicine. So the Speaker of the House, Jeremy Gillum, and the Senate President, Jonathan Dismay, both Republican leaders from White County, they presented to a legislative committee this week, and here's Speaker Gillum presenting his, as he calls it, a challenge to the, his fellow
and
legislators.
Both the House and the Senate in to take the lead in making sure that every home and every business, every school in the state of Arkansas has the appropriate access to broadband, whether that be wired, wireless, but we have to get this accomplished. Now's the time. And so we come before you issuing this challenge to the General Assembly for us to take the lead on this. The governor has started the ball, as I said during the session, with his computer coding initiative. He has a vision like this for the state. He's fully supportive of us taking the lead on this and making sure that by the time we roll into this next general session in 2017, that we have a plan in place to make sure that Arkansas has met this goal.
And Speaker Gillum also made the case, he says, the reason why we need to do this, in particular, Arkansas is very bad at connecting to the internet.
It doesn't really matter what report you look at. I don't think there's a report that really ranks us higher than 45th, 47th. Most of them have us at 49th or 50th with our connectivity.
And no one's really given any specifics on this in terms of how long this will play out or how much money it will cost to implement it where you can literally have broadband access anywhere. But Speaker Gillum kind of spoke to the importance of it, at least that he places in his budget priorities.
It has now become an essential fabric in so many areas, and not even just from a perspective of daily utility, that it maybe even goes beyond that. It has become the fourth rail of economic development. It is just as, I think, important as your transportation infrastructure, your educational workforce infrastructure, your tax structure.
And this is an issue that's got bipartisan support. I think it's really interesting that a lot of the people who are leading the charge on this are from rural areas. Normally, you might think about broadband and tech industries as an urban interest, but these rural representatives are interested. Democratic Minority Leader Michael John Gray, who's from Augusta, I believe, he said this is a great idea. He also thinks of it as important as traditional utilities that you might consider, but his big concern is what's it going to cost? Just sending broadband to every corner of the state is not the same as making it affordable so people can actually have it.
We've talked about telemedicine. We've talked about virtual academy, charter school issues, or just public school issues in general. So it's not just about having internet at the schools and utilizing the existing funds to get quality access there. It's that child that may live, like I grew up, 10 miles outside of town in a non-populated area, that bill for internet is affordable, that it gets paid just like the water bill, the electricity bill. To me, quality access and affordable access statewide today is as important as rural electrification was in the 20s and 30s. So I just want to make sure we don't say, oh, we've got it to everybody. Right. It's got to be affordable to everybody. And the speaker comes from my part of the world. He gets that.
So the goal for this is by the end of summer 2016, they'll have a plan, supposedly, and they hope to enact it in 2017. And the real issue is going to be, especially if you start talking about the cost, is do they hope to spread internet to every quarter of the state? Right now it's around 59% have broadband access. Is that going to take 2 years, 10 years? We just don't have any idea right now.
One of the topics the governor spoke about this week at the Association of Arkansas Administrators in Education was that some schools, 60-odd schools in the state, hadn't implemented, or students weren't taking his computer science courses that were offered this year. And there was an increase in the number of minority students who were enrolling in these STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math classes, but there was some unevenness in the rollout of the classes and interest, and maybe even access to the technology to be able to do the work necessary. What do you think the governor's interest on coding and STEM jobs is what's behind the broadband push?
Speaker Gillum specifically mentioned, he said, this is dovetailing with the governor's push for coding, for bringing high-tech jobs to the state. Early on, he went to Silicon Valley and he's done a number of boosterism-type projects. So that's certainly part of it. And I think with the coding classes, a slim majority of people are taking in-person coding classes, so that would require the computers in the classroom, some teachers, but a lot of people who are taking coding for the first time are doing it through these virtual academies that Michael John Gray sort of referenced. And if you want to be in a virtual academy, you have to have high-quality internet access.
Well, with that, we'll wrap up this week's show. I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
Well, our theme music this week comes to us from Chris Hickey. KUAR is an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or hear the podcast at KUAR.org.